Okay, going further now on the synoptic problem, we'll move away from our gut reaction and our visceral responses here, and we'll become a little bit more academic. It would be useful, I think, for you to go to your Blomberg textbook and follow pages 87 through 90, his reasons for following mark and priority, and that will not coincide with everything that I'm doing in this lecture, but it's I think it would be useful for you to kind of glance at it every now and again. I'm going to be referring here to the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels and the entry there on the synoptic problem by Robert Stein. Robert Stein, as I said in the last lecture, is one of the major evangelical scholars on the synoptic problem. He's written a number of books on it, and in fact I happen to know, because my pastor was a student of his, that in his Introduction to the Gospels he spends half of his time discussing the synoptic problem. So half of the 16 weeks he's going to talk about the synoptic problem. We're not going to do that here at Veritas. If you want to investigate it further, you can do. But he says in a lengthy article here that there are similarities, obvious similarities, in the Synoptic Gospels. There are similarity in wording. And he gives certain passages that you might want to look up. If you've got a harmony in the, of the Gospels, this will be helpful here. He says, compare Matthew 19, verses 13 through 15, with Mark 10, 13 through 16, and Luke 18, 15 through 17. Compare Matthew 24, 4 through 8, with Mark 13, 5 through 8, with Luke 21, 8 through 11. So there are similarities of wording that you'll find there. There are similarities in order. For example, Matthew 16, 12, 46 through 13, 58, with Mark 3, 31 through 6, 6, with Luke 8, 19 through 56. Then there are similarities in what he calls parenthetical material, where there are parentheses. And he notes Matthew 24:15 with Mark 13:14, where you have that insertion, let the reader understand. And he also points to Matthew 9:6 with Mark 2:10 and Luke 5:24 with the saying, and then he said to the paralytic. And then one more, parenthetical, Mark 5:8 with Luke 8:29. Then he points to similarity in biblical quotations. And he says that sometimes one finds the exact form of an Old Testament quotation, but sometimes similarities of the Old Greek translation, the Septuagint. And he says here, this would not be unusual if that form was identical either with the Hebrew Old Testament or the Greek translation of the Old Testament known as the Septuagint. But when we find an identical quotation of the Old Testament which is different from both the Hebrew Old Testament and Greek Old Testament, this similarity requires some sort of explanation. So there is also similarities in the Gospels where you can't find identification with the Hebrew manuscripts or the Septuagint manuscripts. And he gives examples of this in Mark 1:2, Matthew 3:3, and Luke 3:4, Mark 7:7, Matthew 15:9. So he's just pointing generally to similarities in the Gospels. That's all that he's doing in that first section of his essay. Then he says that there obviously, I think, is a literary relationship between the Gospels, that oral transmission that we've looked at and that we will look at cannot explain all of these similarities, because there are certain discourses, for example, the Olivet Discourse, which are so similar it seems hard to believe that oral transmission can explain all of them. It seems that they are sharing each other or sharing some common literary form at certain places. When one takes into account the order of the Gospels, that they seem to follow the same order, that there are similarities of wording, sometimes identification of wording and materials, then it's hard to sustain complete literary independence for the Gospels. Now, there are some people that believe that the Gospels are completely independent, but they are in great minority. Rist, the scholar Rist, is one of those. But there's no reason to posit complete literary independence. There are good reasons for believing that there is literary dependence between the Gospels to a greater or lesser extent. So as there are literary relationships, then we have to ask what kind of literary relationships there are. And there are various explanations of this. There is the what's called the Augustinian explanation, which is that Matthew wrote first, Mark used Matthew, and Luke used Mark. This is what Augustine witnesses to. Now, not just him, by the way, but his name is given to that view. Then there's what's called the Griesbach hypothesis, from J.J. Griesbach, G-R-I-E-S-B-A-C-H, German literary scholar. And Griesbach believed that Matthew wrote first, that Luke used Matthew, that Mark used Matthew and Luke. So Mark would be the last gospel written in the Griesbach hypothesis. Then there is what's called the two-document theory, sometimes called the four-document theory, particularly where I'm from in England. And this is the common one, that Mark wrote first, that Matthew used Mark, that Luke used Mark, and that Matthew and Luke also used another common source, Q. Stein says, quote, of these three theories, the most viable are the latter two, the Griesbach hypothesis and the two-document hypothesis. Now, I'm going to question that, and I'm going to say that the Augustinian view is actually the most reasonable hypothesis. Now, all of them are hypotheses. We can't be absolutely sure on any of these. We have to explain the literary relationships. But whereas most evangelical scholars believe that the two-document theory, that is, that Mark and Q lay behind the Gospels as we have them, I and certain other more scholarly people than me believe in the Augustinian view. That explains these better and actually clears up the problems of the gut reaction that we went through in the last lecture as well. Now, the Griesbach hypothesis, I'm not going to spend very much time on this at all, but as Stein talks about it, he says that the Griesbach hypothesis, which says that Matthew wrote first, that is in line with church tradition. There is a very strong early testimony that Matthew wrote first. When you couple that with the popularity of Matthew's gospel in the early church, there seems to be a strong historical evidence there that Matthew wrote first. So Griesbach put Matthew first. Then, in trying to explain the different agreements between Mark and Luke, and Matthew and Luke, Matthew and Mark, Griesbach believed that these could best be explained if Mark wrote last, and that Mark is picking and choosing between Matthew and Luke. So that Mark, in a sense, is he's already got these two big gospels, Matthew and Luke. These are very popular gospels, they're very full gospels, and he wants to give a kind of abbreviated account. And so he's choosing materials from both of them and weaving in his own materials too. This is what Griesbach thought. And as Stein puts it here, he says, quote, "With regard to the latter, the Griesbach hypothesis is strong where the two-document hypothesis is weak. It can easily explain the Matthew-Luke agreements against Mark." Why? Because Mark decided not to use Matthew or Luke, you see. "Whereas the two-document hypothesis struggles with how Matthew and Luke can agree independently against their Mark and source when they did not know each other. That is, when one did not use the other." Now, we've not got to the two-document hypothesis yet, but just putting that out there, I'm just using Stein. Now, also, the Griesbach hypothesis is supposed to explain what are called the Marken redundancies. Now, a Marken redundancy is something like you find in Mark 1:32, "When evening came as the sun was setting." Why would he say that? Or again in Mark 1:42, "And immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed." And as Stein puts it, "Mark's redundancies are therefore due," in the Griesbach view, "to his having conflated his two sources when he came across different readings." In other words, in Matthew 8:16, we read, "When evening came." In Luke 4:40, we read, "While the sun was setting." And these become, "When the evening came as the sun was setting," in Mark 1:32. That's a conflation, bringing two strands together, making one out of them. So he believes that this can be explained that way. But the Griesbach hypothesis does have problems. First of all, even though it agrees with church tradition on the priority of Matthew's gospel that Matthew wrote first, it disagrees with church history in that the same early witnesses say that Mark wrote second. And so it seems to be begging the question, doesn't it? Because you're going to use church tradition for one of your foundations, but you're going to reject church tradition for your second foundation. Secondly, it seems to have difficulty in explaining the coincidence, as we'll put it, of where Matthew seems to use Mark and then leave off using Mark, and where Luke seems to then come in and use Mark. This seems to be coincidental if, in fact, Mark is last. As Stein puts it here, "Whereas the Griesbach hypothesis can explain all the gospel agreements, in numerous instances, the particular explanation of why two gospels agree against the other two is not persuasive. This is particularly true with regard to Matthew-Mark agreements against Luke, and Mark-Luke agreements against Matthew. In the abstract, the Griesbach hypothesis can explain such agreements easily, but when one seeks to explain why Mark and Luke agree against Matthew, and why Mark and Matthew agree against Luke, the explanations are often quite unconvincing. In general, the attempts on the basis of the Griesbach hypothesis to explain Luke's use of Matthew and Mark's use of Matthew and or Luke are less convincing than the explanations of how Matthew and Luke use Mark, according to the two-document hypothesis." In other words, what he's saying is that the two-document hypothesis, putting Mark first and a Q document, more easily explain the agreements of Matthew and Mark against Luke and Luke and Mark against Matthew. And then to quote here, clearly the vast majority of redaction critical investigation of the Synoptic Gospel, redaction criticism has to do with how has this author edited this portion of the Gospel, or this source, or this saying, or this story, has been based on the view that Matthew and Luke used Mark. Attempts to do redaction critical work on the basis of a Matthean priority are meager and less convincing. Well, we'll look into that a bit later on. There are good reasons for that, because you actually don't need redaction. You don't need editors if you put Matthew first and you have a good explanation for, first of all, Mark being second and Mark's stylistic content differences, and then an explanation for Luke's material as well. If you can provide explanations for those things, you don't need a redaction and you don't need a Q theory. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. I'm trying to stick with Stein's materials here. Stein then goes on to talk about the two-document hypothesis. And it's important that we understand the two-document hypothesis. And it starts off with the priority of Mark. And this is where you might want to follow along with Blomberg here. Because you'll find that Blomberg, in a brief couple of pages, kind of lays out the same reasons for the priority of Mark that Stein does. Stein goes into a bit more detail and maybe includes a few more reasons, okay? First of all, what is the two-document hypothesis? Well, Stein says, this theory argues that Mark was the first gospel written and that it was used independently by Matthew and Luke. It also argues that along with Mark, Matthew and Luke used another common source, which has been called Q. So this is the two document. The two documents are Mark and Q. So what, of course, this theory has to prove is that Mark wrote first. This is what's called Markan priority. And nearly every evangelical and non-evangelical scholar believes in Markan priority. But, there are some very notable exceptions. Notable exceptions in the evangelical camp, those who reject Markan priority, would be, well, Thomas and Farnell, for example, John Wenham, and I believe his son David Wenham. Theodor Zahn rejected it, the great German scholar. Etta Linnemann rejects it, and several other scholars. But interestingly, many people that have rejected Markan priority have been liberal. William Reuben Farmer of the Perkins School of Theology is perhaps the most conspicuous of those. But there are a number of other scholars. And many respected Roman Catholic scholars have rejected Markan priority. Not all of them. People like Fitzmyer and Brown believe in it. But some important scholars like Chapman agree with Wenham and with the Augustinian view of Markan priority. Okay, why do these scholars believe that Mark wrote first? Here are Stein's reasons. The first reason, Mark is the shortest gospel. Mark is the shortest gospel. And I'm going to read here from Stein. Of the three synoptic gospels, Mark is the shortest in length. When their content is compared, that is Mark, Matthew and Luke, 97.2% of Mark is paralleled in Matthew and 88.4% is paralleled in Luke. 97.2% of Mark is paralleled in Matthew and 88.4% is paralleled in Luke. It is easier to understand Matthew and Luke using Mark and choosing to add additional materials to it than to think of Mark using Matthew, Luke, or both, and deciding to omit so much material. Now Stein gives an example. Why would he, that is Mark, have omitted the birth accounts, the Sermon on the Mount, the Lord's Prayer, various resurrection appearances, etc.? It is easier to understand Matthew and Luke choosing to add this material to their Markan source than Mark choosing to omit so much material. The suggestion that Mark may have desired to produce a shorter, more abridged account, that's the greaseback hypothesis, stumbles over the fact that the common accounts of the Synoptic Gospels are generally longer in Mark. So, therefore, where they all three agree, Mark tends to be longer. If Mark wanted to write an abbreviated account of Matthew and or Luke, why would he choose to make the stories in his abridged account longer? These are contrary tendencies. When one seeks to abridge a work, one generally does so not only by eliminating certain materials, but by abridging what one decides to keep. So there's his first reason. Mark is the shortest gospel, and this phenomenon can be best explained if Mark wrote first. Second, Mark has the poorest Greek. And again, quoting, there is a consensus that the Greek of Mark is poorer than that of either Matthew or Luke. It is easier to understand Matthew and Luke using Mark and improving on his Greek than to think of Mark copying the better Greek of Matthew and or Luke and making it worse. There are numerous examples of peculiar Markan expressions, and he talks about colloquialisms in Mark 10:20, grammatical problems, as he puts it, in Mark 4:41, for example. He talks about Mark's Aramaic expressions. Blomberg calls attention to this as well. Mark 3:17, Mark 5:41, 7:11, 7:34, 14:36, 15:22, and 15:34. These Aramaic expressions are not found in Matthew or Luke. It is easier to see Matthew and Luke omitting these Aramaic expressions and giving their Greek counterparts than to see Mark choosing to abridge Matthew and or Luke but adding Aramaic expressions, which his Greek readers did not understand. Third reason, under this heading, general heading, that Mark has the poorest Greek. Mark is frequently redundant. Stein refers to 213 examples of redundancy. And so, Mark is the shortest gospel, Mark has the poorest Greek. Third reason, Mark has harder readings. Now, by harder readings, what Stein generally means is that Mark includes things that seem to create theological difficulties. For example, we find apparent limitations of Jesus' power in Mark 1:32-34, Mark 3:9-10, Mark 6:5-6. In Mark 10:17-18, we find Jesus saying, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone." It is easy to see why Matthew would want to change this to, "Why do you ask me about what is good? One there is who is good." Now, I have to insert here. This is where textual criticism comes into account, because you see, in the majority text and the Textus Receptus, that is not the case. In the majority text, Matthew and Mark are the same. It's, "Why do you call me good?" But if you take the critical text, then there is a difference. Now, there are arguments backwards and forwards as to whether it is not the original authors that are responsible for Matthew's reading, but whether it is people who came after them changing Matthew's account in certain areas. And there is good evidence that they did. As Stein says here, continuing, the changing or explaining of Mark's harder readings by Matthew and or Luke is much easier to understand than Mark choosing to make the easier reading in Matthew or Luke more difficult. Now, probably a lot of you are thinking, well, all of this depends on your assumptions. I mean, Stein is obviously making assumptions as to what he thinks is easier. And keep that in mind. It's very important to keep that in mind. Let's go on to the fifth reason for Mark and priority, which is the lack of Matthew-Luke verbal agreements against Mark. The lack of Matthew-Luke verbal agreements against Mark. And we'll try and take this quite slowly. Stein says, if one observes the various kinds of agreements in the Synoptic Gospels, it is clear that whereas we have numerous Matthew-Mark agreements against Luke, and Luke agreements against Matthew, there is a paucity of Matthew-Luke agreements against Mark. So one has to account for those three phenomena. One has to account for where Matthew and Mark agree against Luke. They have the same or similar content where Luke doesn't. Or where Mark and Luke have those agreements against Matthew. And then account for where Matthew and Luke agree against Mark. And there are relatively few times where they do that. He believes that positing that Mark wrote first is easier to explain than any other way of doing that. And he continues, given the fact that accounts of the triple tradition, that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, seldom show Matthew and Luke agreeing against Mark in their wording, it is easier to believe that Matthew copied from Mark and Luke copied from Mark independently. Next, the lack of Matthew-Luke agreements in order against Mark. So this is not verbal agreements, this is orderly agreements, the arrangement of material. Exciting stuff this, isn't it? And he says here, similar to the preceding argument, but involving the order of the materials, is the observation that when Matthew differs from the order of the accounts found in Mark, Luke never agrees with Matthew. Likewise, when Luke differs from the order which we find in Mark, Matthew never agrees with Luke against Mark. Next, certain literary agreements are best explained by Mark and priority. Again, I'm going to quote. It's important that I quote from Stein, you see, because I disagree with Stein, and therefore I don't want to misrepresent him. I want you to have it from the horse's mouth. And he says, there exist in the Synoptic Gospels certain literary agreements which are best explained on the basis of Matthew and Luke having used Mark. He gives instances. Mark 9, 1 and 2, with Luke 2, 1 to 5, and Luke 5, 17 to 20. He believes that Matthew has abbreviated the Markan account and omitted the reason why Jesus saw the faith of the paralytic and his friends. Again, Matthew 27, 15 through 22, Mark 15, 6 through 13, and Luke 23, 18 through 21. Luke has abbreviated the account and omitted the explanation of the Barabbas episode by not referring to the custom of releasing a prisoner at the time of the Passover. And then, listen to this one. You might want to pin your ears back here. In Matthew 3, 13 through 16, Mark 1, 9 and 10, and Luke 3, 21 and 22, Matthew, and I'm quoting from Stein here, has sought to change the wording of Mark and has, by changing the verb baptized to the participle having been baptized, mistakenly placed the word immediately with the verb went up. So Matthew's made a mistake here. You see that? The result, he says, although understandable, well, we're thankful that he understands Matthew's mistake, has Jesus immediately coming up out of the water rather than immediately seeing the heavens opened. He says, these and other literary agreements are more understandable on the basis of Matthew and Luke having used Mark than on the basis of any other theory of interdependence. Now, I remind you that when I started reading from Stein, he dismissed straight away the Augustinian view, didn't he? This is what we're going to be concentrated on in our next set of lectures. But there are more reasons, two more. First of all, the argument from redaction. This is where the editors come in. And he says this, probably the most significant argument today in favor of the priority of Mark involves redactional studies. It is undeniable that the great majority of redactional investigations of the Synoptic Gospels proceed on the basis of the priority of Mark. Let me reinterpret that for you. That the vast majority of redactional studies presuppose the priority of Mark. Most important that we grasp that, because as I've tried already to tell you, if you presuppose that Mark comes first, you have to presuppose redactional activity, you see. It comes along with it. You have to believe that Matthew and Luke have copied from Mark and changed the material, you see. So it's not surprising, is it, that the vast majority of redactional studies have concentrated on the priority of Mark. They belong and feed off each other. Continue. It is easier, for example, to understand why Matthew added his emphasis on Jesus as the son of David to the Markan account than to understand why Luke and Mark would have chosen to omit this reference. In other words, let's read between the lines here. Mark is the original. Matthew is copying from Mark, but then he is adding son of David to it. It wasn't actually said. That's Matthew. Similarly, it is easier to understand Matthew having added his famous this was to fulfill, which he says a lot, of course, to his Markan source than to understand why Mark and Luke would have chosen to omit them. Again, let me remind you, this is what Stein is saying. This is not what I'm saying. What he thinks is easier is not necessarily what is easier. Your presuppositions, your assumptions come into account here. To continue, we also discover that certain Markan stylistic features, when found in Matthew, appear almost exclusively in the material which Matthew has in common with Mark. The famous Markan use of immediately occurs 41 times within his gospel. In Matthew, it occurs 18 times. Of these 18 times, 14 occur in the material he shares with Mark. That is supposed to be, again, better explained by Matthew copying Mark. And then another Markan stylistic feature is his use of an editorial for, F-O-R, clause, to explain something to his reader. Within Mark, we find 34 such clauses. Within Matthew, we find 10, but all 10 appear in the material he shares with Mark. Not one is found in the remaining material. If Matthew used Mark, the presence of these editorial four clauses is understandable. But why would they be only in one area of the Matthean material, the material he shares with Mark, if Matthew did not use Mark? That's what he's asking. And then finally, you'll like this one, the final reason, Mark's theology is less developed. And this is a reason for Markan priority. The example is that Mark uses the term Lord for Jesus six times, but in Matthew we find it used not only in the same six instances, but in an additional 24. And the same thing with the word Christ. So evidently Mark has a more primitive theology. Matthew and Luke have a more developed theology. Let me read his conclusion here, and then we'll have to stop this lecture. The reason why most scholars maintain the priority of Mark is not based on any one argument listed above. Rather, the priority of Mark is based on the entire collection of arguments. The weight of any one argument may not be convincing, but together they are quite convincing, and the best available hypothesis for explaining the synoptic problem is that Matthew and Luke used Mark in the composition of their Gospels. Being a hypothesis, absolute proof is by definition lacking, and the synoptic problem must always remain open to a better hypothesis should one become available. End quote. So there we are. I've tried to set out the reasons for the priority of Mark. In our next lecture, what we're going to do is that we're going to look at what Stein didn't spend any time looking at, which is that Matthew wrote first, that Mark wrote second, and that Luke wrote third. And so we'll see if there is another alternative that explains, first of all, the witness of the early church, explains the phenomena that we have been looking at, that Stein has been describing, and that obviates the need for, first of all, editorial activity in Matthew and Luke, and explains the common features that we have come across, and of course explains away mark and priority and the supposed Q theory.